Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 155 of Registry Matters. Larry, are you all fat, dumb, and happy from Thanksgiving?
Well, I would say at least a couple of those things.
How about old, fat, dumb, and happy?
That's even better.
I have something to show you. Can you see the camera angle of me?
Sure, I can.
I have something to show you. Can you read this?
No, I can't read anything because it's dark.
It's dark? Well, it says, I am currently unsupervised, and then something about anything is possible at this point.
Well, anything is possible. That's what I've been telling you for years now.
Yes, and if they want to do it, they can do it, they will do it, right?
That's correct.
What do we have going on this episode tonight?
We have an amazing amount of content that we will never be able to get to. We have
better to have too much than not enough, right?
We have 5 listener contributions. We have a case, an appellate decision from New York regarding detention post-sentence, and we have some articles that we may not get to any or only a couple of them, but we have quite a program. So I hope everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we're ready to plow ahead,
whatever. And I guess we will start with the first listener contribution, which you actually said to me to be read first. How about that, right?
Sounds good.
All right, so here we go. From this person, I am writing to inform your organization that no one, at least the ones that I have spoken to at this facility, received the volume XIII, what is that, 13, issue 4, from September 2020 issue. None of us have received any restriction notices either. When I realized I hadn't received the paper newsletter, I resorted to viewing it via email, which I fortunately have. I believe the reason for not receiving the newsletter was because of the story that shed light on this facility. It is clear that the mailroom is censoring articles that are damning to the reputation of this institution. The article did a good job explaining the situation here, and trust me, there is much more that can be said. I just hope by him writing under his name won't lead to retaliatory action against him, as mentioned by some of other writers from that issue. I know of a few cases where individuals would try to write their public official, the press, the ACLU, or other advocacy groups, and had their mail blocked or intercepted, or as most likely with the August-September issue, just thrown away and not delivered to the inmate. I would really like to see some of these people held accountable. These people should be charged with mail tampering. Just because we as inmates have committed a crime to get here doesn't justify our overseers to commit crimes themselves to further punish us. Anyway, I wanted to thank you for your newsletter and just wanted to update you as what happened to the August-September issue. I don't mind you using some of what I've said in this letter, but please use my initials or otherwise hide my identity as I can't afford any unwanted attention at this time. Wow. Can they mess with your mail, Larry, when it's coming into the institution?
Yes, they can. We very carefully considered that article, and I personally reviewed what was in it as the publisher of the Narsil Digest newsletter, and we bent over backwards not to do anything that we felt would compromise institutional security. I mean, the institution, the people there obviously know that at that particular institution and many others that there's a problem. And what we were attempting to do was to illuminate to those on the outside world how critical this situation has become. And if they put up the best argument they could possibly put up, they would say that the fact that the rampant nature of COVID at that institution would cause unrest among the inmates. Therefore, they had a duty to censor that to keep the situation from being unmanageable. But that's a stretch.
They block all kinds of things, whether it's based on certain specific kinds of words that are in there. They block, depending on which place you're at, whether they'll block how much flesh is shown. I'm sure they won't allow anything with like weapons or ammunition in it. So, you know, this isn't an unknown kind of thing for them to intercept or block or, you know, whatever kind of mail coming in.
Well, we are actually consulting with legal people. We're going to consult with other publications that go into prison. There's one biggie called Prison Legal News. And we're going to figure out if we have a cause of action. But what we would really like to know is, did everyone, in fact, not receive the newsletter? And it's difficult to ask that request without identifying the institution. So more generally speaking, if you're in an institution and you're one of our subscribers to the National Digest and you did not receive the October issue, we would sure like to know about it. We would right. really like to know.
And what would be the recourse other than mailing another copy? I mean, can you actually sue the institution?
Well, if they have blocked it without any reason whatsoever, like I say, the best case they could make would be that it would cause unrest among the inmates because it's being exposed that there's a problem. But I kind of think they already know it, that there's a problem. But if what we would do is we would ask a court to compel them to allow the newsletter. The inmates deserve to be informed about things. I mean, that you don't lose complete rights while you're in prison. You have severe restrictions, but you don't lose all rights. And this is one of them where publications have been successful, including Prison Legal News, when they're denied access.
And Charles in chat says, freedom of speech. Do you lose your freedom to receive, to hear speech while you're gone?
You do lose some of that. I was just saying that. Yeah. The institution has an obligation to keep the functioning of the facility safe for everyone, including the staff and the inmates. So you don't have the right to send in something that's going to stir up a ruckus. But we considered that when we published this article. We looked at, is this okay. going to cause a ruckus in any way that they're going to be? And I reviewed every line of the article myself. And okay. I didn't see it, that this would cause any institutional unrest. If people are being taken to sick bay and they're being treated for COVID-19 and they're being taken out on stretchers, I suspect that the way the prison grapevine works, I suspect they already know that inside the prisons.
Gotcha. All right.
Wouldn't you?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So we weren't encouraging an insurrection. We were simply relaying information as seen from a person on the inside of several institutions. That's what we were doing. And it's very difficult for in a normal press relationship, you would seek the other side of the story. We don't find prisons very helpful wanting to give their side of the story when we call them for a question. If we get through to anybody, they don't want to tell. All they do is tell us inmates complain about everything. So we didn't have another side of the story, but they certainly can feel free to write us and tell us that we have not presented the story accurately, and we will consider a rebuttal. If it seems like it's reasonable that what they're saying is remotely true, we would publish that in response to what we published.
I see. Well, then we should move on to number two. This one is fun for me, so I'm gonna turn on my super snarky voice. I'm waiting to sign up to receive your publication. I am incarcerated on a PFR-type crime I did not commit, but I have been given a 10 to 20-year mandatory minimum sentence. After I serve this decade, I'm facing 20 damn years of intensive parole, aka supervised release. This should be illegal to have this sentence, but it is the norm in West Virginia. It should be construed as double jeopardy. I will have already served my time, but will still serve a secondary sentence. My lawyer explained supervised release as parole on steroids. He said they make it hard for parolees to even work. They can call you in for polygraphs, breathalyzers, classes, counseling, or even show up for home visits 24/7. On top of that, in West Virginia, I'm also required to register for life. That is triple jeopardy. I have to carry a stigma around my neck as they used to make criminals wear a dead albatross. In many states, the time is 5 years to register, or you have the ability to petition for registration removal. These rules prevent people from having a fair advantage for employment and housing-wise. Something needs to be done. I plan to fight this archaic, antiquated, biased policy. I hope to glean some knowledge from the publication that will assist me in my fight. Thank you in advance for your help and for being a voice for those of us with these crimes. In solidarity and respect. Larry, are split sentences with mandatory minimums, like, is that double? And then with the registry, is that triple jeopardy?
Well, I feel his pain. And in some cases, the post-prison supervision has been added on. I think in North Carolina, they've done that, and it apparently hasn't been successfully challenged. I'm not totally familiar with Virginia. If he would have known about West Virginia, excuse me, if he would have known about this at the time he was sentenced. But on the surface, simply having a period of incarceration followed by a period of supervision, that is not unconstitutional. So that would not constitute double jeopardy. So he's misguided on that. And then his comment, in many states, the time is 5 years to register. I'd sure like to know where that list of states. What that list of states is, because I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, it was just a 5-year registration obligation. Yeah, so, that's going to be pretty short.
Yeah, I think maybe in Colorado, you might have, for low-level misdemeanors, you might have the ability to get off after 5 years, but I can't think of a list of states where 5 years is enough. So I think he's gotten misinformation on that, which is common within in prison. In terms of what his lawyer told him about this supervision, I'm actually pleased that the lawyer described it accurately, because that's a very good description. Those are things that do happen. I don't know about the middle of the night, but I know that everything else other than the middle of the night happens. The polygraphs, the home visits at all kind of hours, and it doesn't sound all that out of touch with reality, except in there's a couple states where they do it perfectly. One is Maryland, the other one's Georgia. But other than those two... Other than those two states where they treat people properly, all that sounds rather routine.
I will tell you, I never got a visit past, I think, 9:30, and that was only like once in almost 7 years. I only had a visit at 9:30. That was the latest, and then one at super duper early in the morning before breakfast time frame. But otherwise, it was always between, you know, like after lunch to 9 o'clock at night. It was always incredibly reasonable hours. So the 24/7, I know they can come do it I think that kind of has more, and depending on the state, of course, but I think that has more to do with the individual. If they have some sort of inkling that you're effing up, that they're going to come mess with you at different hours. If they don't have any reason, I don't know that they don't want to be up at 2 o'clock in the morning either.
Yes, and I tend to agree with you. My state is particularly bad, but I haven't heard of any 2 o'clock in the morning visits from supervising authorities. But you know, it could be. What I would ask for this person would be for him to write us back again with a little bit more information in terms of, was he made aware of this post-prison supervision at the time? Was that explained to him? And if it was, I mean, this is not double jeopardy. The registry is not triple jeopardy, because the registry, until a court declares it to be punitive, is just simply a civil regulatory scheme, and if West Virginia doesn't have a way off, that's too bad. Some states don't have it's tragic. Some states don't have a way off, and that's sad. But you know, he's not required to live in West Virginia for the rest of his life. He could conceivably go to a state that would have a way off the registry.
Right. Do you some sort of number in your head of how many states have lifetime? Do you?
I don't, but it's a significant number nowadays. There's at least some segment.
Really? Okay.
Well, there's at least some segment of them of the offenders have to register for life. It may not be that it's for everybody. Like Florida, it's for everybody. Alabama's for everybody. But some of the states, if they've done the tier alignment, there will be a lifetime category. And usually, they've put more people in there than what the feds have recommended in the AWA classification system. You know, it's a categorical approach based on your offense, and there are more people put in lifetime than really are required to be. But you can over-tier, you have more problems if you under-tier.
I see. Anything else before we move on to number three?
No, I'm sorry for the guy in West Virginia, for all of our listeners in West Virginia. It sounds like it's not a great place to be.
This next one comes in, and it's 12 days old, and we somehow just sort of missed it. And so we have some excerpts to read. It says, I am a convicted SO with an offense which occurred in 1985. That's almost the year that you were born, Larry. No, that would be 1885.
Correct.
At that time, there were no laws requiring electronic monitoring, registration, SOTP programs, polygraphs, civil commitment, or any other laws associated with this type of offense. I was required to attend a mandatory SOTP program with the attached polygraphs. After 9 months, I was falsely accused of tampering with the GPS device I was required to wear along with the painful ankle monitor. I was ultimately sent back to prison for supposedly failing two polys related to the tampering. And then finally, I would not be here if not for the retroactive laws. Maybe you have a suggestion how to combat this and get reinstated. Do you have contact with CURE? The ACLU, the Department of Justice, other organizations that might care. I don't know what CURE is offhand. I think maybe I've heard it, but it doesn't ring a bell that clearly.
So, yes, it's Citizens United for the Reform of Errants. It's a group that has been at our conferences before. I believe that's the what it stands for. But so we got a little bit to unpack here. So his offense occurred in 1985, and he is correct. We were on the very beginning of development of electronic monitoring in 1985. So that would have been an anomaly for that to exist. Registration other than California, there was no sexual offender registration. Polygraphs were around back then, and I hate to break it to you, civil commitment has been around since the beginning of time. Now, what he's referring to is sex offender specific civil commitment. Rather than just civil commitment. Civil commitment's been around as long as the Republic's been around, I think, or at least close to it. But in terms of that component of it, his offense occurred in 1985. And if the registry has been deemed punitive, if he happens to be in a jurisdiction where the registry has been deemed to be punitive, then he would have something to hang his hat on because they would not be able to apply it to him, the registration requirements, if his description is accurately. So if he's described the situation accurately. Now, Texas, I think, reaches back a lot further. But there are some states where either on the statute it doesn't reach back that far, or the courts have limited them from reaching back that far. So there would be options where he would not have to register. So that would take care of that. And what's his other question? Being sent back for the polygraph. I would very much like to see, I hear this over and over again, and I haven't seen a shred of evidence that has supported it. The tampering with the polygraph, with the GPS, I doubt that the petition to revoke says that he failed the polygraph. What I suspect the petition to revoke says is that the GPS was not worn correctly, was removed, or in some way tampered with. But I doubt they said we are seeking revocation because he failed a polygraph related to tampering. I just haven't seen it yet. If you have such a petition that says that, please send it to us because I want to go on the air on this podcast and say I have seen something I haven't seen yet because everybody says they got revoked for failing a polygraph. They got revoked for an admission they made at the post-polygraph interview is what usually happens. And I don't believe that the petition to revoke his supervision said, as a result of showing deception on the polygraph test, we believe he tampered with his GPS device. I believe they would have said something along the lines of, the GPS device was removed and examined, and it showed evidence of having been tampered with. That's what I would believe the petition would have said.
And then during the poly, they asked him if he had tampered with it, and he said no, and the thing goes all wonky, and they say, hey, you showed deception. He goes, yeah, I messed with it.
Well, he possibly didn't. He could have said, no, I didn't. I don't know why it's showing deception. But they would have had the evidence of the – they would have put on some minuscule evidence showing that the GPS had been tampered with. It's what they likely would have done. Yeah, and it doesn't take much because remember, when you're in a revocation, you don't have the presumption of innocence. You're on conditional liberty. So the rules of evidence are different. The admissibility of evidence is different. The standards of proof are a lot different in a revocation.
Okay.
So you're not trying to prove a new crime.
Right. And you are something of an expert on this whole element too, that you, can you describe more about the whole revocation process?
Well, it depends on if it's a probation or parole revocation. They're two different tracks. One is administrative, if parole's being revoked, and one is judicial, if probation's being revoked. And in the federal system, they have supervised release, and they also have probation, which a few people still get in the federal system. But most revocations in the federal system go through a judicial process. But in a revocation proceeding, since you are already guilty of a crime, the issue is, are you violating the conditions of your supervision? And the standard is usually more likely than not. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not, even by clear and convincing evidence, it's usually whatever moves the conscience of the court slightly in favor of the allegation being true. So they would not have needed to have had as much testimony on the alleged tampering as they would have needed if they were charging him with the crime of destroying the device, a brand new crime. They would have had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he destroyed the device. But if they're just simply using the tampering as a basis for revoking his supervision, they would just had to show him that it was more likely than not that he tampered with it. And that's the standard. And the rules of evidence are much more relaxed. Things that would come in on revocation would never be allowed. Some hearsay is allowed. The cross-examination still happens. You can still cross-examine whoever they put on, but it's a lot more relaxed standard because it is a convicted person who has been given conditional liberty, and they're not being accused of a new crime. They're being accused of violating conditions of that liberty.
I see. And then towards the end, can you help? Maybe you have suggestions on how to combat this and get reinstated. I don't even understand what reinstated would be, but I'm assuming he's just like, get out from underneath this umbrella of garbage. What do you suggest he do?
Well, and he's got to get out of the Texas prison system, we got to figure out how much time he has left in Texas prison. But see, there's always stuff missing from these letters, and they don't know what to write us, and we don't want the voluminous amounts of material. But right. Even though the crime happened in 85, we don't know if they just charged him 2 years ago. Since everybody's eradicated the statute of limitations, you cannot tell how recently this person was charged with it. All we know is he said that the crime occurred in 85. Was he charged 5 years ago? Did he plead guilty? How much time does he have left to go? Does he have any post-prison supervision? If he doesn't have any post-prison supervision, when he gets out the next time, the thing to do would be to leave Texas. Texas has this process for where people get out early because they have such overcrowding. So you'll on a 20-year sentence, you'll do two or three, and you'll be eligible to be released. So when he leaves prison again, he may still have paper hanging over him, and he wouldn't be able to leave Texas. But you're never going to find the promised land. It's not the Lone Star State, I can tell you that.
He says he's 64. He was 29 and stupid in 1985. If parole isn't granted, I can be forced to serve until 2029. So he's got roughly, 8.5 years left. That's a long time. Carl says in chat, leave Texas. That's what I did.
that's my recommendation. You also quit voting for the Law and Order conservatives. But since Texas doesn't show any sign of changing their political views, although there was all this, Texas is going to flip. Well, they didn't flip. This is relevant, though. I'm sorry to tell you that who you elect determines the sentencing and the penalty severity and how people get out of prison. And if you don't want to talk about that, then we don't have to talk about it. But who you elect has to do with how long and in what conditions you're going to serve in prison. And Texas is a hard right state. I'm sorry to tell you, I'm just the messenger here.
I know. All right, now come off of that high horse. So we have a fourth contribution. It says, even though after the FBI thoroughly investigated me and recommended against prosecuting me for downloading what I thought was Third Rock from the Sun, which is a sitcom television show that ran for a long time. It was really CP of Little Girls. And deleting it within seconds when I found out what it was, what it wasn't, the prosecutor pushed for every conviction to get promoted. The new prosecutor wanted to drop my case, but since my paid lawyer had convinced me to plea already, the judge only allowed me to drop the second more serious charges. My lawyer told me that because I'm 100% homosexual, that I'm sick and need to go to prison. I'm now trying to get some relief through the courts. Thank you for your great publication and all your hard work to get in sensible laws changed. All right. So he apparently has, he did not intend to download what he downloaded, which then he ended up with what he wasn't supposed to have. I think he's screwed.
I tend to agree with you. Unfortunately, this is a sort of the Michael Flynn case after you've pled guilty.
Okay.
You know, the Michael Flynn National Security Advisor, former National
Security Advisor. Recently pardoned
one? Yes. And I was going to talk about that, but we've got too much in here already. But there's a slight comparison of that. Once you've pled guilty, then apparently, at least according to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the judge owns you at that point. So his guilty plea by his paid lawyer. Now this is unique because usually it's always the public defenders that get the rep. But he says my paid lawyer had convinced me to plea, and he had retained counsel, as it's referred to, and he pled guilty, and under the doctrine of the D.C. Circuit, the judge owns you at that point. So. I can understand why the prosecutor would not want to let the case go, because they've already got your guilty plea. When the judge read all that stuff, do you understand all these rights you're surrendering? And he said, yes, I do.
And is there anything about like a vendetta about my lawyer told me that I'm 100% gay, homosexual, that I'm sick and need to go to prison? I don't even know where that would come from. You think the DA actually said something to that effect?
Well, he says my lawyer told me. He didn't say the DA.
Right. I'm reading that, and those are the words that he wrote. But I'm thinking that if you hired a lawyer that said that to you, you wouldn't hire. You would immediately unhire that lawyer.
Well, that would be the natural reaction.
I'm thinking he's telling his client what the DA said to it. To me, that's what I'm reading. At least I'm hoping that's what I'm reading. But I can't even see them saying that too, unless it's Jeff Sessions. But.
Now there you go on your high horse. You're criticizing.
I know that man is
an honorable man. An honorable man who did his best to serve the country, and there you go vilifying him.
I know. I'm a terrible person. So what about in your experience, do DAs like really go after people in a personal sense, and that gets to back to the lawyer, which then I can't imagine that you working for a lawyer, that your lawyer would say that to one of the clients. I just can't imagine that comes out.
Yes, they do. There is homophobic prosecutions where the attitude would be much more harsh based on the sexual orientation of the accused. And it does come into play. It would really trouble me if a lawyer that had been retained, or even a non-retained lawyer, if any defense lawyer said that the client was sick. Now, I could see the way you describe it, them saying to the client that the prosecution says you're sick and you need to go to prison. This is the best I can do unless we go to trial. And if we go to trial based on the fact that you confessed and you signed a written confession, and based on the fact this is a federal case, we can deduce that from where he is. He's in a federal correctional institution. Being that they have all their I's dotted and their T's crossed and all this stuff, they would get a conviction. I could see him saying that this is the best I can get from this prosecution here, and if we go to trial, we're going to have a worse outcome. I could see something like that being said, but I don't think the lawyer should have been telling his client that he was sick. But you could relay that to a client and say, this is what they think of you. That's the reason why I encourage people when I tell them you can't actually have a conversation with the prosecution. They're not going to tell you how sick they think you are.
Sure. Hey, this is another one. Well, I don't know. If you were the one doing like the pro se thing and you called up the DA, would they tell you in this case? We talked about that all the time where you can't really call the DA and say, hey, what do you think about me? They may tell you in this case.
They're going to do everything they can to avoid talking to you if you try to reach out. If you're, first of all, the court's going to do everything they can to make sure you're represented. And with a serious charge, they're going to at least have a legal advisor. I mean, sometimes nuts do represent themselves, but the prosecution is going to do everything they can to avoid talking to you. That's just the way it is. I didn't write that rule, but that's the way it is because of a number of reasons, including that it wouldn't be very healthy for them to tell you that they think you're sick. I mean, how would you react to that? The average person wouldn't react very well.
I don't think that would go over well.
Well, then what if you wanted to retaliate? So they're just not going to tell you that.
Yeah, sure. Sure. There are definitely ways that if you go onto the video sharing websites that would let you download TV shows and whatnot, it is not hard for you to end up in a spot where you're downloading stuff that is not what you intended. You know, you're downloading the latest music video of Britney Spears and, you know, it starts out for 2 seconds being that, but that's the end of that and it turns into something entirely different. And they're tracking IP addresses of the FBI and so forth, the three-letter agencies. They'll capture your IP address, find out your address from your internet service provider, and next thing you know, you're getting a knock at the door at probably 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that is what I hear. I don't understand all that, but I hear that all the time, that no one had any intent. But again, when we talk about defunding the police, this is one of the reasons why we talk about curtailing their funding. If they had less funding, they would not be able to bring these type of cases against you and your loved ones. So when you automatically object to any type of reduction of funding, because defunding is nobody's talking about defunding the police. But when we talk about curtailing their funding, this is an example of the reason why.
Right. I'm with you there. And our final contribution, this one, I'm going to read it all, but it's not that bad. It says, well, the reason I'm writing today is because I'm in need of some assistance from you. I was convicted in Dallas County for the offense of ag sexual assault of a minor, which I'm completely innocent of. Yeah, I know, that's hard to believe someone in my situation. But Narsal, you already know how hard it is for someone to believe in someone in my situation. I've been searching for help during my 11 years of incarceration, but up to now, no one has granted me an opportunity. And I understand why people refuse to help me out of the nature of the offense that lawyers won't work or fight for this type of case. Also, due to the public backlash towards them, it makes them look sympathetic to these types of cases. That's very wrong because there are some that actually didn't commit the crime. But I came across your address in a legal prison news or prison legal news, and I was wondering if by chance you might be able to help me and guide me in the right direction. Please, I sincerely need some help. I just need someone to believe in me and guide me in the right direction because this is hard. Also, can I pay for 1 year of the digest? Blah, 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 blah. Well, thank you very much for your time in this matter. It's very important to me. I think that's pretty much. Oh, also, happy Thanksgiving and Merry Christmas to everybody.
I put this in here because it comes from, again, from Texas, from a state prisoner in Texas. And that state is not known for being lenient or rehabilitative oriented. And when he said that he can't find anybody to help him, it's kind of like when you tell a letter to the editor, when you tell the senior editor that I know you won't publish this, most of them bristle and they said, well, let me look at it and I'll see why. Well, I'm guessing that what he's saying is he cannot find anybody who will take his case pro bono.
Right.
And I have to remind him that we're in a system of capitalism. And these lawyers, these cases that in today's age are very complicated. We don't know the extent of what what the evidence was they held on him. We don't know if he pled guilty. All we know is the title ag sexual assault of a minor. But we don't know if he pled or if he went to trial. But if he pled, the avenue is open to a person to undo a plea are so small that even if he had gobs of money, if the lawyer had integrity, they would tell him it's going to be very difficult to undo this plea. if he went to trial and was convicted, there's more doors open, but it's still an uphill battle because at that point, you're no longer presumed innocent. You're presumed guilty. Guess who the burden shifts to at that point?
I guess it shifts to you.
It does indeed. And you've got to come up with some evidence that is substantial in nature. And the first thing people want to come up with in evidence is recantation. And that's the worst evidence they can come up with is recantation, because all that proves is the person is a liar, which makes anything they say unbelievable, which makes the prosecution say, well, if you go forth now and tell this story, which is not what you testified to under oath at trial, I'm going to prosecute you for perjury. And that usually disincentivizes a person quite a bit when they tell them, I'm going to lock you up for perjury.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
and even if they don't go to that extreme, they tell them on cross-examination, they're going to demonize you. They're going to say, well, now, wait a minute. Now you're telling this story today at this habeas hearing, but you testified to this at trial. So we can see that there's two different stories, and it's clear that both of them cannot be true. So you are admitting that you're a liar, aren't you? You are a liar, aren't you? You have no choice but to admit that you're a liar, because sure. The evidence is showing you clearly to be a liar. There's two different stories that have come out of your mouth. And then you say, okay, so now that you're an admitted liar, should we believe anything that you say? And, of course, the answer is, well, I am an admitted liar because you forced me to lie initially because of the way you and your office threatened me if I didn't. Now that I see the consequences of that lie, now I would like to rectify it. And I can clearly see that you don't have any conscience about how you're handling your office, and you don't mind an innocent person staying in prison. That's the answer. Of course, they're going to try to cut you off before you get through with all that. But
you got to have some big cojones to say all that too.
But that is what you should say. So we don't know enough about his case to know the basis for his innocence claim. But what we do know is that if he pled, there are exceedingly few options to undo that. And if he went to trial, there are a few more. But there are those actions are time sensitive. And he has to have been pursuing those claims, and he may, in fact, be time-barred on some stuff. And if he doesn't have any money, then this is one of the pitfalls of our capitalist system. You know, it's very hard. I mean, I know that you would not believe it would be fair to take from a lawyer and force them to provide their services at no cost, would you?
They want to make every penny, right?
But I'm saying, what right do we have to confiscate from a lawyer, from a law firm, their services without compensation? Isn't that unconstitutional and un-American?
It's definitely un-American. I don't know about the unconstitutional part.
Well, it
to
would
force
be,
someone to work for free? Yeah, that's probably. I don't know if that. Yeah.
So, and I think slavery. I think that's kind of what he's saying here is that he hasn't been able to find anyone who can take his case pro bono. And the reason is because trying to unravel a conviction is going to be exceedingly difficult, long shot at best, and it's going to devour a lot of practice time to no avail. In most cases, no avail. There are convictions that are undone, and people do work for free. But that can't be an expectation in a capitalist system. We have to figure out a way to fund this, and I can just about guess that Texas does the bare minimum they can do in post-conviction relief, because that's not a state where you're going to get a lot of support when you say, we need to help more people undo their convictions. I just don't think that would play well with the average Texan.
Probably not. They want less government. Anything else before we then move on to something of our feature event?
Let's do it. We've already been at this for an hour and a half.
Almost. It's 39 minutes as I count. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747 227 4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. All right. Well, you put this thing in here. It's about the New York Court of Appeals says prison post-sentence detention is constitutional. So you put this decision in here for us to discuss. It's over 80 pages, Larry. Do you actually think that I can read 80 pages of legal mumbo jumbo?
No.
That is why I am here.
And you're going to then like break it and then start laughing.
Oh, I did that pretty well this time, didn't I? I've got that voice down.
Almost, yes. Oh. Yes, you do.
So, well, that
so
is
you're
why.
Here to discuss it with us, though.
That is why I'm here.
So first tell me what is so unique about this case. Everybody knows that parole is not right and that they can hold you in prison after you pass your parole eligibility date. So why are we focusing on what everyone already knows?
Well, that is exactly why we're focusing on this, because there are distinguishing factors about when a person is eligible to be released from prison. And this particular consolidated appeal, it was two cases, but it presents the opportunity for us to distinguish the difference in parole as it's understood generally, and periods of supervised release that may be called parole that follows the expiration of a person's sentence. And this consolidated appeal of two different cases, it involves both of them. One of them had an indeterminate sentence up to life, and the other one had a determinate sentence which had expired. So that's what's so fun about this case. And so we can have fun with it.
Okay. And is this about people that get some sort of final date? Here, you're going to get released from prison on January 31st. January 31st rolls around and they go, no, not today.
Well, again, it was two different cases. One of them had a parole eligibility date because he was serving a sentence that was 2 to life, I think, or something to life.
Okay. Okay.
And he had been granted a parole eligibility date in 2017. We had another guy. We had that was Johnson, and then Ortiz had a 10-year sentence which expired in 2018, and at the end of his finite of his determinate period of time, he wasn't able to be released, and he had a period of post-release supervision. They refer to as PRS in New York. So he would have normally walked out the gate, except for they detained him because of what we're going to dig into in this case. So we had an indeterminate sentence and we had a determinate sentence, and they were both held for different reasons. But that's what we're going to get into.
You used the term a minute ago about a consolidated case, which, I mean, I realize consolidated means they like joined them. But if they have two separate cases, don't you end up with like double cases being combined if you do a class action?
No, what they did was this was two different individuals who had filed petitions for writ of habeas corpus and challenging the legality of their detention. And the trial court denied the habeas petition, so the appeal was consolidated at the state's highest court, which I think they refer to as the Court of Appeals. I thought Maryland was the only court that the state that referred to their highest court, but apparently the highest court in New York is the Court of Appeals, and they consolidated the two cases because they dealt with the same issue of whether a person can be held beyond continue to be held in detention after they're eligible to be released. And the Ortiz challenger, his case was more compelling because he had served all of his time. The other one, he had not served all of his time. They would release him when he completed his life sentence. And then I can promise you they'll release him at that point.
Probably in some sort of a container, a little vessel, like a box of some sort, right? So what did the court decide, I guess, would be the next sort of logical question.
Well, they decided that in both cases that they can continue to hold people. In the case of Johnson, they said it was not even a close call. That discretionary parole is a generous act, and you have no right to that. So therefore, even though you're eligible for it, you have no expectation of that liberty. So it was not hard to determine his case. So his was an emphatic denial. But they said in the Ortiz case that his challenge was presented a closer call because of the nuances of his situation. He had served all of his time. And when you've served all your time, you generally expect to go home, right?
I think so. I mean, I was kind of excited when they said, hey, it's your time to go home, and they opened the doors.
But in New York, he had some things that worked against him that we generally think were for. Everybody thinks that they're for a risk-based system. You know, don't confuse us with tiers, because we've got a lot of that goes on out there. But New York does a risk-based analysis, where they determine through a process that's maybe not perfect, but there's a process by which they determine what level of threat that you pose. And that's a part of the Sex Offender Registration Act, SORA. And they had determined both of these individuals to be a level 3, which triggered the Sexual Assault Reduction Act comes into play, because under the sexual assault under SARA, a level 3 can't live within 1,000 feet of all these things.
Sure.
Which in New York City would probably be an awful lot of things. That would be, I mean, when you got a densely populated area, you'd probably have a whole lot of difficulty finding a place to live that wasn't within 1,000 feet of something. So the combination of SORA and the risk-based system with the requirements of SARA, the Sexual Assault Reduction Act, that these people who had their due process to determine what threat they posed to the community, they were determined to pose a high threat to the community. So therefore, they did not have the right to live at any place they chose, particularly while they're being punished. Because the post-prison supervision, regardless of whether it was, in the case of Ortiz, where it was a period of post-prison supervision, or if it was traditional parole, it's still a form of their punishment. And the court said that we can't put a person in immediate violation of their supervision. Their supervising officer is supposed to assure they're compliant. So therefore, since you cannot live in the places you want to live without being in violation, you'd be in violation from the get-go. So in order for the safety of the community, you need to be held in detention. So they sent them to a residential facility. That it wasn't supposedly a what they called it, RTF residential treatment facility. So they sent Ortiz to one of those facilities, and he still had too much restrictions. And he said, he put forth a very clever argument. He said that they should let him come and go as he pleases, because he was not there for punishment. He said he was there simply because he didn't have a place to go. So therefore, his restrictions should be almost non-existent, and the court didn't buy that either. But I mean, you have to give him credit. That is a pretty creative argument,
right?
At least I thought.
And you can't find an address. At least from the way that I'm interpreting what has happened here is, you get out, and they would then figure out that you can't comply, and then lock you back up. They're not going to hold you preemptively because you can't get an address before you get out. They would. In Georgia, they would let you out and then nail you on the other side that you can't be in compliance.
Yeah, well, but that's different in New York. New York has SARA, the Sexual Assault Reduction Act. And SARA says that a person who's been assigned to level 3 cannot live within 1,000 feet of all these things. So your argument, your position is logical. Usually we'll let people break the law, but they're saying you'd be in violation. The court said they'd be in violation from the get-go. So therefore, this is kind of a preventive measure, so that they don't go non-compliant from day one. But there were so many arguments. This case took a lot of twists and turns about the level, the standard of review, and about whether it should be under the state or the federal constitution. And they didn't adequately plead the state constitution because New York's constitution provides greater protection than the federal constitution. But they just tiptoed around it, and they didn't assert a state constitutional claim. So this was decided under the United States Constitution. And they found that in view of the individualized process that determined that these two were dangerous, that they could be held. And that's the highest court in the state. So that's kind of the law of New York now.
And I was reading through the case, and both of them had actually gotten out before this case, by the time the case was on appeal, but they kept litigating at that point. Like, why would you still care if you've already gotten out?
Well, it may be that the lawyers cared more than this is one of those cases where we talk about the mootness doctrine. And the state will always argue that your case has been extinguished because your dispute has been resolved. But you can argue exception to that. And this is a prime example of an exception, something that's capable of repetition. So we don't believe that these are the last two sexual offenders that might encounter this. So this is clearly capable of repetition. And then this has continuously evaded judicial review because the people have somehow had their issue resolved before it got fully litigated on appeal. So this is one of those prime examples of exception to the mootness. So you would argue as an attorney that, yes, my client's issue has resolved itself, but this case is not moot because it falls into the narrow exceptions to the mootness doctrine. And this would be one of them, a very fine example of exception to mootness.
And how long, I'm trying to think, how long could they hold these individuals in custody?
Well, in the case of Johnson, they could hold him until he serves out the entirety of his life sentence. But in the case of Ortiz, they could only hold him for his 5 years of post-prison supervision. And at that point, they would have to release him because that's the only thing they held him on was he had post-prison supervision.
And forgive me, I'm going to be like extreme here. Like when you say they're getting held past their sentence, they're getting put up in the Hilton with the swimming pool and the jacuzzi, or are they staying in prison?
Well, they were transferred to a residential treatment facility, which is a part of a prison. I didn't delve into how much it was like a prison. I can imagine it was considerably like a prison, but theoretically, if you're in a residential facility, there would be some coming and going. Else, I don't know how you could refer to it as residential.
Okay. Do you think it's like a halfway house?
No, I don't. I think it's like a prison facility. It's be kind of like work release from a jail.
Okay.
I think it's probably an adjacent to a prison facility where there's maybe not all the barbed wire and towers, but you still have more like a correctional setting. But this is where we would need a New Yorker to really come explain the two facilities that were named in the case. And I don't know either one of them. You know, those names don't mean anything to me, but a New Yorker might know.
You've talked about things similar, I think, in a couple other states, maybe like Illinois and New Mexico. Does this do anything to dump those down the toilet?
That was my first fear until I went through it, and then I realized how they got to their outcome. And I don't think it really does, because in the case of New Mexico, which I'm more authoritative on than Illinois, but there's a great deal of similarity. In New Mexico, our Sex Offender Registration Act does not have a risk-based component. So you have not gone through that process in the state. And what happens here is that you serve all your time, and then you go into what they've labeled parole. And when you don't have an address that satisfies the parole board, they continue to hold you in custody. So there's been no individual. This is a broad brush that we apply here. So I don't think it really is going to hurt us much. We would try to distinguish our way out of it. First of all, it's not even binding. It's just persuasive authority. But we would argue that it's not all that persuasive because it's so distinguishable from what we have here. We don't have discretionary parole. I mean, you earn your parole by serving all your time.
And then even things like the SARA, the Sexual Assault Reduction Act, I'm assuming you don't have something like that there as well to pile on extra conditions on top of.
We don't have that. We don't have a statute. See, that's a statutory that was signed by Governor Pataki that came out in the opinion.
How do you know names like that?
Well, it came out in the opinion. That was in, it was signed by Governor Pataki that came out of it. And I don't know if he was the driving force behind it or not, or if it was one of those things that just made it to his desk. But anyway, it was in the opinion that it was signed by him. And we don't have anything statute. We just have policies. You know, the corrections department has a policy that you can't be within 1,000 feet of things. Statutes carry more impact than policy, because the statutes have been vetted by all the people. A policy has been vetted by a bureaucrat.
Okay, and fine. I guess I don't know of anything else to ask about. Do they have any options for appeal? Any other further steps that they can take?
Well, being that it's a highest tribunal in the state, they would be able to file a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, because this was decided on the U.S. Constitution. So if they don't like the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, they could ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review it. I have a feeling that the U.S. Supreme Court would come down on a similar outcome because of the system in New York. And I would hate for this to go to the U.S. Supreme Court and them come out with that decision, because then everybody would say, see, you can hold people in prison after they've done their time. The U.S. Supreme Court said so. So I hope this doesn't go to the Supreme Court, but they could conceivably do that. But since these people are in the community, it's not likely they're going to spend all that effort going to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Hmm. And then also, what, 8,000 or 9,000 requests go up there, and they serve 1% of those?
1% of those, and the state would say there's no need that this case, the state would, well, first of all, the state wouldn't file a response, they would ignore it. But if the court directed them to file a response, if they were interested in enough that they wanted a response, they would say that this has all been resolved, these people are out of custody. No need, nothing here to see, is what they would say.
Taking things off the script a little bit, I mean, this happens in several other states where people like finish their sentence, they are, you know, directed out the door, where they go get locked up somewhere else for civil commitment for some indeterminate amount of time.
Well,
am I confusing two subjects?
You're confusing two subjects. The civil commitment is an independent process that requires a mental abnormality, and they file a petition seeking the commitment. This was just being done because of the nuances of the law. You know, the civil commitment is an independent process that is initiated against you.
Okay. So this is just, you don't have an address, we can't let you get out of prison. That's pretty much all this is.
That is correct. You're a level 3. You don't have a compliant address with Sarah. You're required to have a compliant address. You agreed to that, and therefore you get to sit here until we get your compliant address. But they put them in a residential facility, which I don't know what additional freedom that gives them.
Sure. And so the one person only had 5 years to serve, and the other one had something of a life sentence. So the 5-year person could only be held up to that 5-year limit, and then they would be free to go. The other person would just be there for, indefinitely.
Potentially, yes. Until he serves a sentence.
So weird. So weird. Is there anything else that we need to know about this before we move on?
No, I think I've done the best I could. It was exceedingly complicated to try, and there was 2 dissenting opinions that were longer than the majority opinion. And I just did a glance of the dissenting opinions, but if there were going to be a cert petition, that would be where you would use dissenting opinions. You'd go in there and you would clip out all the great stuff in the dissent, and you would say, this is why you should consider this case, because of these brilliantly written dissenting opinions.
I see. Why is this important to us, though? Why is this important to the PFRs and the Registry Matters listeners at large?
Well, if you were in the New York correctional system, it would be extremely important to you, because you know that you better work really hard to find suitable housing, because the highest tribunal in your state has said you can be held in custody if you don't have suitable housing. So you do the best you can. And New York actually does provide better reentry resources than many other states. So there was even discussion of the New York City shelter system. Apparently, you have a statutory right to shelter to the extent that they're not overcrowded. But for some reason, they could not find a shelter within that elaborate system that would that complied with 1,000 feet. All the shelters were within 1,000 feet of something.
Yeah. That seems to be a pretty common thing too, in other states as well. Are you ready to move on to something of a lightning round of some articles? See if how many we can cover in the next 10 or so minutes?
Well, let's do it. I think we can cover all of them.
All right. Maybe. All right. The first one comes from The Appeal. Some Texas elections suggest voters aren't afraid of defunding the police. Do you want to describe again, just real quick, what this defunding the police means?
It's a fancy term, a scare tactic that the right wingers have come up with to convince people that every dollar the police get is sacred and that you can't even discuss any reallocation, any. The police always have to have everything and more. But defunding the police doesn't mean that we would be without police protection. It only means that looking at the overall commitment of public resources to law enforcement, would there be a better utilization to divert some of those resources to treatment, prevention, and to rehabilitation? That's all it means. But somehow or another, of the many catchy lines, that one really took off. Defund the police. Defund the police. And it became central in the campaign, and people voted a lot on that. I'm not going to vote for the Democrat Party because they're talking about defunding the police, and no one is talking about defunding the police. Everyone recognizes that there needs to be law enforcement. I don't care what socioeconomic group you go, they recognize the need for police. They recognize the need for significant police reform and re-examination of how all this vast bureaucracy got to the level of funding where, in most instances, local governments, 50% or more of a local government is all spent on law enforcement. Of all the things that cities do, half of it goes to public safety or more.
Right. Yeah, I've heard a bunch of segments on different radio programs, and almost every city that they cover, like 50% of the budget goes to the police force somehow, some form or fashion is what I mean to say. The subheading for this article is none of the Austin City Council members who voted to cut police funding lost their elections, but a police union vice president who fear-mongered about the defund movement did. Do you, like, I don't know. Austin's a pretty progressive city in the Texas state overall. And I got to think that this would be very isolated to Austin. I can't see Texas doing this as a whole.
You beat me to the punch. That's what I was going to say. I don't know that we can extrapolate when we compare an urban setting where they tend to be more progressive. I don't know that we can compare a San Francisco and an Austin. I don't know that we can compare that to other parts of the country. But it is a good start that the people that had the courage in Austin to say it's time to look at making some changes, they were not voted out. Same thing in Minneapolis, where one of the city councilors that was on the cutting edge of saying that we need to reform the police before George Floyd, he had courage. I mean, when you're speaking against the police, it takes an awful lot of courage because of the power that they wield.
Very true, very true. Anything else?
No, see how quick that was.
I know. All right, then from the New York Times, and what would you like us to call it? What does your favorite radio host call it?
Oh, that would be the New York Slimes, I think.
Ah, okay. America is letting the coronavirus rage through prisons. It's both a moral failure and a public health one. Actually, someone sent me an article the other day about a prison in Georgia that it was a very long, very, I don't want to call it a hit job, but it was a very revealing thing about how bad COVID is at a particular prison. Happened to be a big place that I was at. And I can't imagine that any prison would be the model of, like, we have this completely under control. There's no problem here. Like, and actually be true. It's got to be awful at every institution.
So, well, it's not anything that we can solve here, but during the week of November 17th, there were 13,657 new coronavirus infections reported across state and federal prison populations, according to the Marshall Project. And that is by far the highest weekly total. And then they report that more than 1,450 prisoners have died. And we were on the beginning of this, the pandemic, when we were saying we're going to have to cut the prison populations dramatically. We didn't do that. These people are right. Trapped, and there's no way they can't even get masks. We had an article we were going to cover last week from a sheriff in Colorado that wouldn't even provide them a mask until they had rampant infection. I believe that was El Paso County, Colorado. But there's one thing that we could be learning from this possibly, is if this is leading to herd immunity. I mean, there's a theory that if you just won't wear a mask and you just let it run rampant, that somehow or another that the population will become immune, it'll take care of itself. So wouldn't we be getting some good feedback from prisons? Is it working?
Actually an incredibly good point, because you have a very controlled, isolated population, you know, of hundreds of people, that it wouldn't take long to get everyone sort of exposed, so forth. Like, yeah, that's actually an interesting kind of point. It's a controlled experiment. Interesting. And I don't think they're achieving any level of herd immunity.
Well, I mean, in county jails, the turnover is too fast. But in prisons where there's a more stable turnover, particularly the admissions to prisons have dropped because new cases have the putting people in has really dropped because they can't run trials and they can't run the court systems with any efficiency right now. So I would think the population is relatively stable except for internal movement. So we would be getting some possible evidence in terms of the herd immunity. I'm not saying I buy into it, but I mean, there are people who say we just should let it do its thing. And we'll have immunity.
Yeah, I hear that.
And so.
And I think they're kind of nuts. I bet you those people are some of the ones that have never had anybody super close to them get infected to any degree.
Well, as of mid-November, they say 196,000. Some might as well say 200,000. And we've got roughly a couple million people in state and federal prisons. So you've got an infection rate that's about 10%, it looks like to me.
Right. Yeah. Because then it says the correctional system, and for employees too. 685,000 people are employed, and 45,000 of them have been reported coronavirus infections. That's just shy of 10%. So it's running pretty high amongst those two.
And only 100 deaths versus 1,400 deaths of the prisoners. Not that I'm minimizing 100, it's not. But it is one of those things where we all saw this coming, but we couldn't do anything about it.
I don't know what to tell you, man. Then moving over to another one from the appeal. This is Andrew Cuomo promised criminal justice reforms, but New York is still waiting. The governor's rolled back bail reform, not released enough prisoners during the pandemic, and failed to rein in police abuses, advocates and prisoners say.
So, well, I couldn't help myself putting this one in here. I want the conservatives who listen, who say that I don't bash liberals, I want you to listen very carefully, because I'm going on a tirade here.
Oh, boy, here we go.
This governor, who grandstands as being a reformer, has been anything but a reformer. If he'd spend a little bit less time grandstanding and a little bit more time working on reform, then we'd be a lot further along in this. But this reminds me of our governor here that was going to be a reformer. And there's been scant reforms in the criminal justice area. And it's one thing. One, we had the previous governor, who was a prosecutor, who made it clear that she was about locking up as many people for as long as possible. There's no bait and switch there. But when you present yourself as being a reformer, then I'd like to see a little bit of reform. And from what this appeal article describes, there's been scant reform and scant leadership from the governor's office. And that's very disappointing. If you want to present yourself as being the savior to the nation and we should follow New York on everything, then show some leadership and courage. It's easy to criticize Trump for everything he did wrong, but now it's your turn to be criticized. Where are you on criminal justice reform?
Certainly that. They've got to have a huge number of people locked up in New York.
Well, he did, his office did make reference to that the prison state prison population is the lowest it's been since some point in the 1980s. But it's still, according to the experts in New York, it's not anything near where they need to be in terms of making reforms. And some of the things that they do in New York, I'll tell you, don't serve our interest. That Sexual Assault Reduction Act, that made it right. Almost impossible for anybody to have a house there. But that sure made the victims' advocates feel good. And I guarantee you that was bipartisan support. Plenty of that when that passed. That would be one of those things where both parties would have signed up and said, count me in.
But that's a typical thing. You know, I like to paint things with blue or red brushes. A pretty blue thing is to really cater to the victims' advocates versus red seems to push back on that somewhat more. And I don't know which side to favor, but I don't know which. Oh God, I don't even know how to word that one. Pushing back seems to be. I don't know, like a thumbing, thumbing your fingers at the people, trying to push it back, just trying to hold the line, I guess. I'm not really sure how to word it. Kowtowing to the victim advocates versus pushing back on them so hard.
So, well, it's very hard to push back on the victim's advocates because they come in with such a united front, and they know how to be very emotional. But as far as the reforms, like bail reform, everybody recognizes that our system needs some adjustments. I'm not necessarily on board with everything that they are doing or have done or want to do, but I don't think, as a matter of fact, we have an article, if we get to it later, where we're going to be talking about a $2 million bail. But sometimes you have to be courageous, even though you're going to take a political hit. If you're too bold with criminal justice reform, the conservatives are going to hit you. That's just a given. They're going to do it.
Yeah.
and you have to go ahead and prepare your population for it. I am going to be vilified, and here's why. But this is the right thing to do, and here's why. And you hope you can survive it, but you may not. And he may have other, Cuomo, that is, he may have other priorities that are more important to him, and he doesn't want to spend his time fighting off the vilification. I mean, all you have to do is look at when you try to be courageous, you get vilified because you're turning loose a tidal wave of crime, and that generally comes from the conservatives. It doesn't come from the liberals.
Another article that we have from The Appeal is Kyle Rittenhouse bought his freedom. Kylief Browder could not. Rittenhouse case raises particularly pointed questions about what we're really talking about when we talk about bail. I think this is what you were alluding to just a minute ago.
Yes. And I, interestingly enough, I come down on the side of, I know we're going to want to assume he's guilty, but he has the right to be presumed innocent until he is proven guilty in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt. And that presumption is supposed to follow him through duration of the proceedings. And if you're presumed innocent, we cannot act as if you're guilty and say that he should be paying a price right now for what he did. We do not know that he did that yet. And I don't know why that's so hard for the victim's advocates to understand. He is entitled to the presumption that he didn't do anything. And it's your job to prove that what he did do, that he's guilty of what we're saying he did. And until then, he's an innocent person. I say the same thing about police officers that are accused. I only wish the police would say it about someone who's accused, because that's the way our system works. I don't consider him buying his freedom. I mean, I know what they're getting at, because they're people who have very low cash bonds that they can't make the cash bonds because they don't have, doesn't matter how low it is. If it's $100 and you don't have the 100, it might as well be 10,000. And there are people who also should be enjoying that presumption of innocence, and they're not enjoying it because they're incarcerated. I totally get that, and I understand it. But does that mean we should punish everybody because we're in a capitalist system and some people can't afford to make the bail?
And what we're really describing here is that two people, one of them had a $2 million bond. Wow, that's a lot of money. And that family had the resources to get donations and so forth to pay something of like, what that would have been, like $250,000 bond, because it's like 12% or 11% to pull off bond. And but the other person, I'm going to assume for whatever it could have been $50 a bond. I don't see it in the article, but couldn't raise that money. So that person is still sitting behind the walls while this $2 million bond, Kyle's friends and family put together $2 million a bond.
Well, he had donors in the community because there are people who, despite how guilty they think he is, they're going to support that. And I'm not want to get into a debate about what is guilty or innocent, he strikes a chord with a certain segment of the population that they can identify with, and they've made donations to him. But that doesn't change the fact he's presumed innocent.
Yes.
And for some reason, we can't wrap our head around that. The people that are sitting in on the $50 and $100 bond, they are presumed innocent. And I say the same thing about them. It's unfortunate that in our system that they can't be released. Is the answer to punish everybody pretrial because some people don't have capital in a capitalist system? Is that the answer?
I'm going to read this one little paragraph a little bit more than halfway down. It says, Kylief Browder spent 3 years in jail, most of them in solitary confinement for allegedly stealing a backpack, and because he couldn't afford his freedom. At 16 years old, he was wrongfully incarcerated for a crime he did not commit. A system that locks innocent children and adults in cages is not just or smart, it's cruel. When he was released, Kylief Browder tragically died by suicide. In stark comparison, Kyle Rittenhouse has been heralded a hero. 16 years old, Larry, for allegedly stealing a backpack.
Well, and then we're getting into the juvenile system versus the adult system, and there's greater latitude generally in the juvenile system. So I don't know of Browder's case, what the nuances were, why he was held in custody. It's certainly a tragedy. Nothing could describe the tragedy of him committing suicide. But we need to figure out, in a capitalist system, what do we do with people who don't have capital?
Yeah, I don't know what the answer to that one is, Larry. I just don't.
Because the bail reform systems are not as the panacea that you think they are. They end up looking at the seriousness of the accusations, and on this accusation under that cash register system that they would use, he would have gotten so many points because of the weapon, the type of weapon, and the fact that he left the state and he had to be extradited back. He would have so many points that he would be unbondable. So that would all but destroy his presumption of innocence, wouldn't it?
It seems like, yeah.
Yeah. So he would have, at least in this particular case, and I'm not rooting for him. If he's guilty, I'm not rooting for him at all. I just don't have an opinion because I don't know enough. But in this particular case, he at least can facilitate and prepare and work with his defense team. Everybody should be able to do that. Everybody, even in jail pretrial, should have unfettered access to their legal team, which they don't. They never have. But I don't know how to fix the system. We live in a capitalist system. We have to figure out in a capitalist system, how do we deal with people who don't have capital?
I do not know, Larry. Larry, let's jump to the very end of the list. This is from ProPublica. A deputy prosecutor was fired for speaking out against jail time for people who fall behind on rent. Like, I didn't realize that it was some kind of crime, like a prosecutable crime, to not pay your rent. I figured that you would just get evicted and possibly owe some money, like you'd be put into collections or something, but I didn't realize that you could be like charged for not paying rent.
Well, apparently in Arkansas, it is against the law. If this is an accurate article, now your ProPublica is one that you like. So is this?
I like ProPublica.
Well, this is in Garland County, Arkansas, but apparently it is the option to go civil or criminal for failure to pay rent. It says under the law, which dates to 1901.
Good grief.
If the rent is a day overdue, they forfeit the right to be on the property. If they don't leave the homes within 10 days of getting notice to their landlords, they can be charged with misdemeanor and fined for each day that they overstay.
And okay, now help me out. What is the consequences of a misdemeanor? Like a speeding ticket is a misdemeanor, as if I understand right.
Well, the consequences, depending on what type of misdemeanor, can be severe. The domestic violence is oftentimes a misdemeanor, but it's severe, the consequences of that. Of having a DWI.
You need to have a failure to pay rent registry.
I don't see a problem with it. But anyway, this deputy prosecutor voiced his opinion, I guess gave an interview, and it got back to the elected prosecutor, and she did not see the humor in this at all. And so she let him go.
Oh, okay.
Oh. So this is one where Josh deserves the kudos, and the elected prosecutor doesn't deserve anything other than she's got a point. It is the law. She doesn't make the law. But you certainly have a prosecutor's association, and you have extreme clout with the state legislature, and you could be in Little Rock saying, look, we need to repeal this archaic law that's 120 years old. We don't want to be prosecuting people. So Michelle Lawrence, the prosecuting attorney of Garland County, shame on you. You should be trying to undo this law. And Josh Drake, congratulations for speaking truth to power. It cost you your job, Josh, but guess what? You'll go on to do better things.
Let's hope so. Wow, that's bizarre. That's just really bizarre. Larry, do you know that we got an amazing number of patrons this week?
How amazing was the number?
It was two. We got two new patrons. We got a Derek and a Jessica, and I want to thank you both very, 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 very much. Thank you so very much. It's really, really appreciated.
Aren't we getting close to that magic 100?
We are getting closer. We are getting closer. What are we going to do? Are we going to do like a 12-hour live stream when we get to 100 patrons, Larry?
We should do something, but yeah, I think we're at 83. I logged into my account yesterday, and I think it was 82, so this will make 83.
A podcast that I listened to, they crossed 4,000 patrons, and they're doing a 12 or 24. I can't remember which one it is, which is unbelievably insane to me. I can't imagine trying to record anything for that long, Larry. By the end of it, we'd both be like, we would not be very coherent, quite kind of people by then, I imagine.
Well,
how do people reach the podcast, Mr. Larry?
We've done amazing to get to this level. You know, when we started, we had zero.
That is true. We did have to get to one before we got to two and so forth.
So how do they
reach? Where do people find the show?
It's online.
the tubes of the internet. I can't remember. Who was the guy from like Indiana, someplace over west? He called it the tubes. I'm always tickled when I hear that clip of the tubes.
It's registrymatters.co.
All right. And then how about
not com, but just co.
Yes. We couldn't afford the extra letter. It was too expensive. So we reduced it by one. What about a phone number, Larry?
747-227-4477.
And sending us an email, where would they do that?
Oh, that would be easy. registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And as Derek and Jessica did, you can find us over at patreon.com/registrymatters. That is the best way to support the podcast, to show some love for the Larryinator, for being the one that knows all the things. And I thank you so very much for being here, Larry.
It is my pleasure.
That is
I'm always.
I am here.
Where's your cue, man? I try this every week and you flush it.
Well, you already did. I didn't know you were going to do it again.
All right, man.
Well, just bleep it out. Let's do it again.
All right, Larry, I very much appreciate having you here, and I hope we can do it again very soon.
That is why I am here.
You're supposed to say it. All right, anyway, we're out of here. I hope everybody has a great night, the rest of your weekend. I hope you didn't get too fat from all the turkey. And we will talk to you again next week. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.